Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers, in particular Alain and Hugues, for their very nice invitation to participate to this meeting. I will infect a little bit with bacteria this meeting. I will dwell upon the impact of the gut microbiota in immuno-oncology. So I am a founder of a biotech company devoted in the R&D of live biotherapeutics. There has been a growing awareness from the researchers, as well as the oncologists and the journalists, in the potential impact of the gut microbiota in cancer immunosurveillance and in tumor biology, as illustrated by this wonderful review in a wonderful journal, Cancer Discovery, written by Hanan, describing the hallmarks of cancer and including the gut microbes. So this work has been possible with a generous contribution and intimate relationship with a variety of different investigators that generously gave their vision, their reagents, and their views very early on, trying to publish in back-to-back and expedite the dissemination of the data, and I think it's very important to do so. And I would like also to thank the founding bodies, the CIRE Foundation, the French government, and the European Commission. So the cancer immune set point is a threshold beyond which an immune response can ensure, and beyond which immunomodulation can give a good clinical outcome. The cancer immune set point is governed by a variety of different factors, notably the cancer and the host genetics, but also comorbidities, co-medications, environmental factors, and today I would like to introduce the microbiota. You have to acknowledge that we are a meta-organism in which our mammalian part has co-evolved for millennia in a mutualistic symbiosis with thousands of bacteria, phages, viruses, fungi, parasites that line onto a 200 square meter intestinal surface separated by the inner milieu by only 20 micrometers, exerting a variety of seminal functions, notably the absorption of the nutrients, the elimination of the xenobiotics and the pathogens, the peristaltism, and more importantly, the maturation of the immune system and the fitness of the epithelial barrier for a full-blown fitness. So the demonstration of the impact of the gut microbiota on immunomodulation relies on four major pillars that I will detail. First, antibiotics. So we have been able to show back in 2018 that patients that took antibiotics prior to the administration of immune checkpoint inhibitors didn't benefit so much from their anti-PD-1 treatment prescribed in second line in the context of non-small cell lung and kidney cancer patients. About 30% of individuals take antibiotics prior to their treatment. So this has been extended in 18 different studies, encompassing more than 12,000 patients in this meta-analysis across at least four different malignancies, across different classes of antibiotics, except vancomycin. And this is not only for PFS, but also OS and objective response rate. And as you can see, the HR, so the deleterious effect of antibiotics is 2.26, which is quite remarkable. So, meaning that antibiotics kill the gut bacteria, and by doing so, they reshuffle the composition of the gut composition, of course. So the idea is to show a cause-effect relationship between the gut composition and the failure of the immunotherapy. So we use the avatar mouse model in which germ-free animals or antibiotic-treated mice receive, by oral feeding, the fecal material from patient at baseline. And by doing so, we can then thereafter inoculate a cancer and treat with anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies. And we could show that the mere transfer of fecal material from patients at baseline doomed to fail the therapy is actually conferring the resistance to these animals. In sharp contrast, The other way around can be demonstrated when you use fecal material from responders, and this will confer sensitivity to the recipient. So, of course, if the gut microbiota composition dictates the preclinical outcome, it made sense for a number of investigators to look at how the gut microbial composition defined by the 16S ribosomal RNA sequencing or the shotgun metagenomic sequencing could actually influence the patient's prognosis. And so first, we analyzed more than 1,600 patients and compared them with healthy volunteers at the level of the composition of the gut defined by this 16S ribosomal RNA sequencing or shotgun metagenomics. And we show across 8 different cancer models, either early or late cancer models, that actually in linear discriminating analysis of effect size, the metagenomic species dominating the cancer patients over the healthy volunteers, a line here, can be significantly observed, and at the expense of the beneficial bacteria sitting here in blue. And in fact, when we turn to the same analysis, trying to segregate non-responders versus responders to immunotherapy across 14 different studies and 8 different cancer types, we also redundantly show that some metagenomic species seems to overrule the others that are more beneficial. But most interestingly, we found commonalities, meaning that the enterocluster genus composed of this specific bacteria, for instance, Clostridium bolte or Clostridium asparagiforme or Clostridium formae, are actually common. So they dominate and overrule cancer patients, and we can find them in non-responders, and they actually at the expense of the Lactospiraceae family members, notably Eubacteriaceae or Ruminococcaceae or Dorea, and the balance between this Clostridium, this enterocluster genus, and the Lactospiraceae is actually dictating the dysbiosis of a given patient. So, it's complex, and maybe we are going to simplify this algorithm. And so we found out that a regulatory bacterium called Akkermansia mucinifila is very interesting. Akkermansia is to the gut what poppy is to the meadow, meaning the indirect witness of a healthy soil. So Akkermansia mucinifila is one of these gram-negative bacterium, mucin consumer and mucin degrading bacterium that is actually responsible or very linked to longevity and also to the prevention of insulinoresistance in type 2 diabetes and obesity. And actually the relative abundance as well as the prevalence of these bacteria can actually dictate the prognosis of patients diagnosed with a non-small cell lung cancer and kidney cancer. So this is a prospective analysis duplicating a retrospective one already published, showing that there is a trichotomic distribution of Akkermansia in the gut of our patients, with the vast majority being sadly negative, and a few, 10% about, that are expressing too much of Akkermansia above the 70th percentile. And this translates into a very different outcome. Those patients that have Akkermansia to a normal level, the light blue, are actually very good patients. They have they benefit from PD-1 blockade, while the others, and specifically those that have too much of Akkermansia or the negative ones, fail to do so. And so we can recapitulate in avatar mice the relevance, the clinical significance of this data by simply compensating Akkermansia negative patients and or avatar mice with this particular isolate of Akkermansia that seems to compensate for the lack of response to PD-1 blockade of those feces that confer resistance. And of course, those stools that have already Akkermansia at the first place respond, they confer sensitivity, and they do not need exogenous Akkermansia. So, Now, what is the mode of action and how come that commensals residing in the gut can act at a remote site against extra-intestinal malignancies? So without mode of action, you do not convince anyone. You do not convince the FDA or the EMA for any approval of any medication. And you do not convince the crowd like you to join the field. So I'm going to dwell on three vignettes to show you that there are specific modes of action that are extremely interesting and that you cannot ignore any longer. First of all, this is general view that bugs can offer, of course, ligands for pattern recognition receptors. They can also offer some antigens that seems to have a molecular mimicry with oncogenes. They can bring some metabolites like inosine that will signal through IL-12 receptor, and we heard yesterday how important is IL-12 receptor signaling and beyond interferon gamma. These bugs are, of course, very important to maintain the epithelial barrier fitness, preventing the gut permeability and the translocation of endotoxinemia, which is very immunosuppressive. And finally, you have bad guys, and those bad guys, what they do is a lot of different things, but mainly suffice to say that Fusobacterium nucleatum, by bringing FAP2, will bind to TIGIT and will signal through inhibitory receptor in lymphocytes. Besides, you have some bugs that are very tricky, and they metabolize directly the drugs that you confer to patients, like, for instance, ruminococci that can transform androgen deprivation therapies into testosterone or dehypoandrosterone, meaning that they do the contrary of what you want to do with androgen deprivation. And some other bugs can, for instance, the proteobacteria, they digest gemcitabine, and this is also counterproductive for the patient. So I would like to dwell on my first vignette showing that some bacteria, for instance, Enterococcus cerae, but also Enterococcus faecalis, they can be lysogenized by phages, and these phages confer the antigenicity to this bacterium. So for instance, here we were able to identify in the tail of this sideroviridae enterophage a stretch of peptide, amino acid stretch of peptide that can bind to MHC class 1 molecule. And this will elicit CD8 T cell responses against the phage epitope. And those T cells can be redirected to cancer, recognize PSMB4, which is a proteasomal subunit, an oncogene overexpressed without any mutation in a variety of different mouse tumors. And in fact, this can be sensed by the immune system. Why? Because the enterococcus that is lysogenized by the phage can translocate from the ileum to the spleen following a treatment with cyclophosphamide. And so the bacterium translocate, and then the phage of the bacterium can be recognized by T cells, and these T cells cross-react against an antigen that shares a 78% homology with the phage antigen, and in that case, it is a proteasomal subunit. If you knock in the proteasomal subunit, the phage no longer elicits an anti-tumor protective immune response. And if you adoptively transfer, if you genetically modify an enterococcus with the phage antigen, you restore the antigenicity to this enterococcus that was not antigenic at the first place. Second vignette, I would like to dwell upon something that a story that has been nicely developed by Marine Fidel, was something to see with the molecular cues underlying the immunosuppressive effect of antibiotics. So antibiotics, what they do is that they downregulate the mucosal adhesin, MADCAM, that is a ligand for alpha-4 beta-7 integrin that is normally expressed by gut enterotropic T cells. And so by doing so, when you have a downregulation of MADCAM at the level which is normally expressed in high endothelial venules of Peyer patches, of mesenteric lymph nodes, and ileal venules, Then when MAdCAM is downregulated, the alpha 4 beta 7 T cells from the gut are actually undergoing an exodus, and they leave and traffic back, attracted by other gradients such as cancers, and they end up in the tumor bed, and they exert an immunosuppressive function. So how does that work? Actually, when you stop antibiotics, what grows out are opportunistic bacteria, namely Enterocluster genus belonging bacteria. And these bacteria overcome, and they have the power to downregulate MAdCAM on these high endothelial venules. And this is interesting to note that the MAdCAM alpha 4 beta 7 axis is actually extremely clinically relevant in the context of PD-1 blockade in mice bearing cancer and also in patients. So I'm going to show you a couple of slides, only two, to just illustrate what I was just summarizing in this graphical abstract. For instance, if you treat cancer bearers with anti-PD-1 and you compare the relative efficacy of these antibodies in wild-type animals versus MAdCAM knockout mice, you see that in MAdCAM knockout mice, this antibody fails to promote any anti-tumor effects. A similar finding is obtained using the beta-7 integrin knockout mouse that no longer respond to PD-1 blockade. And this is also shown across different cancer models. Interestingly, anti-PD-1, anti-MAdCAM antibodies, as well as an antibody neutralizing the heterodimeric form IFA4 beta-7 of this integrin, are exactly mimicking what we obtain in this genetic model. So it's not just true in mice, it's also true in patients, where it's possible to monitor the serum circulating levels of this mucosal adhesin, MAdCAM, and you see that patients that took antibiotics have lower levels of soluble MAdCAM. And if you segregate this cohort of non-small cell lung cancer patients according to the median of the soluble MAdCAM in the blood, you see that you can segregate the responders from the non-responders. And this has been obtained in two independent series of non-small cell lung cancer patients treated in first line or second line PD-1 blockade. So to visualize, so I told you, so how come that this can happen? I was telling to you that alpha 4 beta 7 T cells residing in the gut, which are enterotropic T cells, can leave the gut and ending up into intestinal tumors. And actually, to demonstrate that, we use two tricks, a CFSC injection into mesenteric lymph node, or we took advantage of these KD mice, generously given by the Institut Pasteur. So this is a coral photoconvertible protein. And so when you open these KD mice, and if you illuminate with UV light, with a proper nanometer wavelength, you can transform the green into red, and you can follow the immigration of the illuminated gut T cells towards the skin tumors. And so by doing so, you could see that the alpha 4 beta 7, sorry about that, the alpha 4 beta 7 Tregs are the main cells that in both types of methodology are emigrating from the tumor, from the gut to the tumor. And so you can phenocopy these effects using an anti-MAdCAM neutralizing antibody, which will promote the exodus of these T cells from the gut to the tumor. And when you do a deeper characterization of these emigrating enterotropic T cells, you can observe that they are ROR gamma T and FOXP3, so they are TR17 cells. And so ACS means broad spectrum antibiotics. You see that the neutralization of MAdCAM is phenocopied by the antibiotics taken and arrested 4 days later. However, when you seize antibiotics, the emigration of this TR17 from the gut to the tumor is only can be only perceived for the a couple of days, so 7 days or so, and by day 12 it no longer exists. Surprisingly, if you treat the animals concomitantly with a PD-1 blockade, then you maintain the emigration of this TR17 from the gut to the tumor. And this could explain the hyperprogressors, because as you know, some patients, when they are treated with PD-1, anti-PD-1 antibodies, instead of responding, they flare up. And this could be explained by the fact that these patients were dysbiotic at the first place, reason why their Tregs emigrated from the gut to the tumor. And I will show you that this is very deleterious, this emigration and this pool of intestinal T cells accumulating in extraintestinal tumor beds, because it prevents the effector CCR5 positive CD8s from accumulating. And if you block IL-17 by a neutralizing anti-IL-17 antibodies, you prevent the deleterious effect of these enterotropic T cells in this immunotherapy. IL-22 is also produced by this TR17, as many of you may know. Actually, if you use an IL-22 receptor alpha knockout tumor, you don't see any difference, meaning that IL-22 do not seem to be involved in the immunosuppressive effect of these enterotropic T cells. So now I would like to dwell on my third vignette, which has to do with the fact that cancer per se is actually has a corollary syndrome, which is the stress ileopathy. So cancer is sensed by the ileum, and this sensing is actually promoting cancer outgrowth. So in fact, a very talented pathologist from Japan, Yonekura, has been able to show that at day 7 after tumor inoculation in mice, there was a stress in the ileopathy, meaning a mucosal atrophy in a patchy manner. And this mucosal atrophy could be characterized by an apoptosis of the crypt of the ileum, was strictly localized in the ileum at the very first place, and then moved to the jejunum, but never touched the colon. And so this crypt apoptosis was accompanied by a defect in the proliferation of the transient amplifying cell. And this was also satellite from the accumulation of goblet-producing cells, mucin-producing goblet cells, degranulation of Paneth cells, excretion of antimicrobial peptide, gut permeability leading to endotoxinemia, as well as tumor outgrowth. And this could be sensed in 50% of mouse tumors only. And interestingly, even though this gut permeability and this atrophy is more or less transient, there is a protracted gut dysbiosis that is maintained until animal sacrifice. This is not new, I will tell you, because this has been already published back 40 years ago in the 1960s or so by pathologists that were very talented and said, well, look, advanced cancer patients are coming up with a very obvious atrophy of the jejunum and the ileum. But these papers were detracted by peers because there was a confounding factor in this cancer patient, which was cachexia. And so it was also these patients were treated with pyrimidines, and pyrimidines are associated with side effects. So all the whole story was just sent into the trash, and nobody anymore dared to talk about stress ileopathy in cancer patients. However, we, of course, went back to the bench and said, well, look, maybe there is a cachexia in our animals and we have to double check. So there was no weight loss, no bleeding of the gut, no IL-6 in the circulation. And we could instead see a disbalance between sympathetic and sympathetic and parasympathetic signaling. That can be illustrated here by the decrease of the stroma cholinergic acetyl transferase and an accumulation of cells overproducing tyrosine hydroxylase, which is this enzyme that converts dopamine into norepinephrine and epinephrine. And so these cells are the ectopic, correspond to the ectopic proliferation of enteroendocrine cells. So if this stress ileopathy is actually the cause of the sensing of growing cancer, we were interested in using pharmacologic as well as genetic means to dampen this disbalance between sympathetic and parasympathetic signaling. And we ended up showing that beta 2 blockers and adrenaline receptor beta 2 knockout no longer perceive cancer progression. And this ileopathy monitored by the villus creep ratio is no longer perceived. And in fact, when you treat these animals with beta blockers at the same time you administer anti-PD-1 antibodies, you increase and end up with a synergistic effect. So actually, this is not even new, because melanoma-treating oncologists had already reported that patients on the beta blockers are doing much better than the others when treated with PD-1 blockade. So I told you that this is an epiphenomenon, if I can say so, because what is important is a protracted dysbiosis that is left over after the stress ileopathy has more or less healed by itself. So we were interested in showing and demonstrating the clinical relevance of this dysbiosis, and to do so we use antibiotics and we monitored the crypt over villus ratio. And actually only one antibiotic could blunt that, vancomycin. So vancomycin is a good guy, it's a good antibiotic that kills gram-positive bacteria, and by doing so it eliminates, I will tell you, subset of bacteria that are very involved in this ileopathy. And in fact, if you treat with vancomycin, tumors tend to reduce their aggressiveness. And to show the direct relationship between gut dysbiosis and tumor severity, we simply co-housed animals that were injected with this procarcinogen, 3-methylcholantrane. Normally, these guys should have an incidence and the severity of the disease, which is a sarcoma, by about 80 days. You can see the sarcoma progressing. But when these animals have been co-housed with litter mates that were naive animals, not inoculated with cancer, we could retard and prevent, in some cases, the outgrowth, the severity, and the dissemination of the sarcoma. So these animals are coprophagic. That's the reason why they can benefit or not from the composition of the gut of the litter mates. So I told you that vancomycin is a good guy. In fact, the linear discrimination analysis of effect size with or without vancomycin is indicating that vancomycin eliminates this Clostridium, Clostridioforme, Asparagiforme, the guys that I was telling to you about that were actually associated with a cancer signature and the resistance to immunotherapy signature. So those bad guys are eliminated by vancomycin, and in fact, we can show that they are directly harmful for the response and the immunomodulation mediated by PD-1 blockade by simply performing an oral gavage prior to PD-1 blockade. And we could appreciate that, in fact, the delta of the beneficial effect was disappearing after oral gavage with this deleterious bacteria. So, in fact, Leonardo Lordello, another very talented Brazilian anapath pathologist, came to the lab and identified that, in fact, in cancer patients, we also see this ectopic proliferation of enteroendocrine cells in the villus of the ileum. We also see this caspase-3 cleavage in the crypt, with a correlation between these two parameters that are the hallmarks of stress ileopathy. And we also can see that this ectopic proliferation of enteroendocrine cells is visible not only in colorectal cancer patients, but also in genitourinary cancer patients and in NET patients. So in fact, in these cancer-bearing patients, as I was alluding at a moment ago, whether advanced or not advanced, some cancer patients I would say the vast majority of them, they show up with a dysbiosis at diagnosis, and this dysbiosis is characterized by the overgrowth of this enterocluster genus belonging bacteria at the expense of this Lactospiraceae, so meaning the E. bacteriaceae, and the Aurea and the Ruminococcaceae, which are the bacteria that are a little bit famous in those fibers-enriched diet eaters. So finally, I would like to finish with the good news, how these discoveries can impact on the clinical outcome of patients. So first, these pilot studies that were published in back-to-back in Science showing that you can circumvent the primary resistance of cancer patients to PD-1 blockade by the mere transfer of allogeneic stools from melanoma patients cured from their disease. So it occurred in about one-third cases in these 26 first patients in these two independent studies. And for that to happen, at least you need the stools to engraft in the intestinal of the recipient. This engraftment is a corollary of a complete reprogramming of the systemic immune tonus as well as the cancer immunosurveillance landscape. For instance, the MAIT got activated, the CD8s in the blood get a cytolytic profile. We can also observe the loss of the inflammatory tonus in the blood. So, for instance, the IL-8 is decreasing, while FLAT3 ligand and CXCL13, which is a token of TFH and TLH, and TLS, sorry, is happening. So, and we see a reshuffling of the metabolomics of this patient with some secondary biliary acid over-dominating the profile of this metabolism. So another very compelling evidence is the one concerning metastatic renal cell carcinoma patient in first line that were normally treated with ipi-nivo. So interestingly, if they are randomized against ipi-nivo plus the Japanese probiotic Clostridium butyricum, you see that there is a great advantage of taking the triplets over just the combinatorial immune checkpoint inhibitor regimen. The mode of action is unclear. So I could not not talk about what is interesting for our colleagues in CAR T cells. So the CAR T cell experts were also able to show that if patients receive large spectrum antibiotics prior to their CAR T cell administration, they hardly respond to CAR T cell therapy and they exhibit neurological toxicity. And this was related to the dominance of bad bugs over good bugs, always the same good bugs with lactospiraceae and the bad bugs are velonellaceae, which we have also in our list of patients' resistance to immunotherapy in the lung cancer model. So I couldn't finish without telling a little bit about the tumor microbiome. So in contrast to the common sense, we are not sterile. And when we have a cancer, the cancer is not sterile, even if the cancer is not at the portal of entry. And it was shown that some bacteria, Escherichia coli PKS or Fusobacterium nucleatum or ETBF, they can actually, through their capacity to counter genomic repair, DNA repair, or to sustain proliferation, or to exhibit pro-inflammatory activity, or by avoiding immunosurveillance, they will have, per se, a pro-tumorigenic indirect effect. The other thing which is very interesting, and this is the other face of the genus, of the coin, is that some bacteria, by invading the tumor cells directly, they can end up in the endosomal compartments and they will be processed and presented in MHC class 1 and class 2 complexes at the cell tumor cell surface, being visible to the TILs and enabling some T cell clones to take over. So this was a provocative publication by Yardenia Samuel. And in fact, we were able to recapitulate these findings, but turning to bladder cancer, to muscle-invasive urothelial carcinoma that were treated with neoadjuvant pembrolizumab. And so one-third of these patients will respond to this neoadjuvant pembrolizumab. And in fact, the responders are those that are already infected with uropathogenic E. coli that we could identify in fish, in electron microscopy, and in PCR. This experiment was done by Pierre Lee in my lab, a very talented technician. And in fact, these patients that can recognize their bacteria and mount a TFH CXCL13 producing TFH immunity, as well as a B-cell response culminating in the anti-E. coli IgG secretion, those patients are the ones that are electively responding to neoadjuvant pembrolizumab. And we got a beautiful correlation between the B and the TFH response, as alluded yesterday by a number of speakers. Interestingly, if you turn to the other bacteria that are commonly infected, infecting these individuals, you fail to see a clinical relevance. So for UPEC, it works. For the other bacteria, it doesn't work. And maybe it has something to do with their capacity to infect, to invade, or to be processed by the endosomes. So this story is actually triplicated. So we got not only Pandore, but we got Nabucco, and we got MatShare. And so in all the studies that we put a hand on, we could see the predictive role of the titers of the anti-E. coli IgG responses to predict response to pembrolizumab. So this work has been performed by this very, 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 very talented PhD student that become a postdoc now in Michael Peters' lab in Lausanne, Anne-Gaëlle Goubet. And the paper is in revision in Cancer Discovery, but will be accepted, I think, very easily. So I would like to now finish with the take-home message. I hope that you are convinced that...
I think it is indeed time to finish.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you very much for this nice precision. So microbiota has earned a spot in the oncological armamentarium, and I would like to say that at the level of cancer diagnostic, prognostic, prediction, and optimization of the treatment, I couldn't allude to that too much today, but next time. And I would like just to say that at Gustave Roussy, the directors have put a certain emphasis so that every single patient will have a diagnosis of gut dysbiosis, and every single patient that will be amenable to immune checkpoint blockade should be eligible for a ketogenic diet or free doxybutyrate or allogenic fecal microbial transplantation or Akkermansia, depending on his gut profile. I would like to thank all the investigators, my very, very, very talented young investigators, Lisa De Rosa and Bertrand Routy, as well as the key opinion leaders in the lung and in the kidney, the metagenomics experts that were absolutely wonderful, and our star, our French stars that you can easily recognize, as well as all the PhD and the postdocs that you can are listed here, Imran Lamar, Leonardo Lordello, Marine Fidel, and Carolina Alves Costa Silva, Jean Eudes, and so on. I am really grateful to their outstanding work, and also our new postdoc that just came recently in the lab and has got a very renewed fellowship. So, and I would like to thank the others. Thank you very much. Thank you.